About that meditation, you may know that in concentration practices, so-called, we choose an object of meditation or attention and become increasingly absorbed in it. And as we become increasingly absorbed in it, it becomes increasingly concentrated in us as we become concentrated in it. And there's a lot of Buddhist practice that's very much about that and the value of that. And I've come to really appreciate what I think of as blends, like calm strength is a blend, or feeling both peaceful and content is a blend. And the blend we did here was to feel grounded, loving, and at peace as some kind of blend. And then as we take that as an object of meditation, much as you might take the sensations of breathing as an object of meditation, you're literally training your brain to become really more settled in being peaceful, grounded, and loving as a kind of trait. You're developing a trait by marinating in its states. Pretty good. I like that. Okay. So I want to talk about our old friend, anxiety, which experientially is really on a range. So I kind of want to mark it from very subtle forms of guardedness. Often we don't realize we're anxious because we're living inside a very small cage. And so, yeah, as long as we're inside the cage with its invisible bars of our very safe, comfortable, you know, inhibited way of living, then we're not anxious. So we don't, well, I'm not anxious. Well, imagine how it would be if you took one step outside the perimeter of the boundaries, the bounds you set for yourself. Whoa, that'd be scary. So anxiety often shows up in its absence based on what we do to avoid feeling anxious. That's worth noting right there. And then we can have subtleties of uneasiness, you know, apprehensiveness, starting to grow with a sense of worry. Maybe we're worried about something, we're preoccupied about it. A lot of what anxiety is about is anticipation, anticipatory anxiety. And so there's a future that we're worried about. There's a threat, a looming threat, or a certain threat. You know, I have a friend who needs to get a bone marrow biopsy this week, and it's quite something to do that. And understandably, you know, there's anxiety about that. So then we keep moving further into being really afraid, really preoccupied, invasive sense of dread, almost overwhelming, almost paralyzing, moving into panic and terror. Extreme versions of this. That whole range. So context, of course, is that anxiety in its full range, and that's what I'm referring to when I speak about anxiety, is normal. Arguably, the neural apparatus for emotion was first specialized for fear and disgust because, you know, that goes to the negativity bias of the brain and our need for raw survival to get away from threats. First and foremost, in the wild, eat lunch today, right? Don't be lunch today. So anxiety is normal. It has functions. It's trying to help us. Now, maybe it's a really burdensome, well-intended friend. Okay. Lighten up, anxiety, but still, deep down, it's trying to serve a function. So before I get into using insight to release needless anxiety, first I want to pay anxiety its due when it's needful. In other words, there's nothing in what I'm going to get at that's about positive thinking or, you know, putting your head in the sand or, you know, as the physicians say, hope is not a plan. Yes, have hope and also have a plan. So it's important to take care of real threats. Action binds anxiety, a kind of helpless dread. It's really bad. So as much as you can, take the actions you can take out in the world, in your body, in your relationships, and in your mind. It's really important. Make a list. Make a plan. Your situation may still be really messed up, but at least you've got kind of a plan, including what you're going to do inside your own mind to make the best of it. This is very contextual, and it certainly applies to external situations like the politics in your country, the state of the world, the heating up of the planet. We can make plans for dealing with threats without being invaded by anxiety. One of the Buddha's great teachings from his own personal story and his journey toward awakening was that there came a time, as he put it, when painful, racking feelings arose, but they did not invade my mind and remain. We can deal with threats on the basis of feeling resourced and strong inside and with wisdom perspectives around ultimate possibilities, and not feel anxious while still coping fiercely and effectively with threatening situations. Really important to appreciate that. Okay, so that's very contextual here. So with that as a bit of a preamble, I want to borrow from the combination of psychoanalysis, somatic psychology, and fundamental Buddhist wisdom to explore three kinds of insight that can liberate you from needless anxiety. Here we go. So Freud often gets a bad rap. It's real easy to, take down the big dog and make your bones that way. He had a lot of great stuff to teach. He was a real pioneer. A couple of key points here. One is that the view in psychoanalytic theory that we're dealing with multiple dynamic forces in our mind, and sometimes there's a struggle between what the outer world asks of us and what's actually authentically true, including younger, more fundamental, more passionate, more id-like desires or reactions of various kinds, emotions of various kinds. So what we tend to do, and this is grounded in, Freud's background in the Victorian era in upper middle class Vienna, in his own background, we tend to suppress, we push stuff down. And then when it starts to move forward, we kind of get anxious about it. And by the way, this is not an attempt to explain all anxiety, but to foster insight for a certain kind of anxiety. And as that material, like longings to be loved, or to be special, or to impress others, or to explore certain kinds of pleasures. As that material starts to move forward, there's an anticipatory anxiety about, oh, no, what will happen if? And so this is a major opportunity for insight that has to do with moving back the bars of your invisible cage. Maybe what you're anxious about is not so much the external world, or even what would happen in the external world, it's what you would feel if you expressed yourself more fully in your important relationships, and then they might react. So the issue is not their reaction. The issue is the dreaded experience that you might feel if you lived a little bit larger in X form and they did Y, because you dread then that you would feel Z. This is a fundamental structure of a lot of psychological constriction, fear of the dreaded experience. And it may sound a little complicated, but it's actually not. You just work backwards. What am I really afraid I would feel? Because when I was young, I did feel it. Or I watched other people feeling it. Or I imagined that I would feel it. What am I afraid to experience? Usually, when you do this, you realize that the odds of the bad event are much lower today. Second, what you would feel would not be so bad today. Yeah, it might be unpleasant, but it would be fairly mild and it wouldn't last very long. And third, you're much more able to cope with what you might feel today than you were when you were young. Wow. That's insight. That's self-understanding. Now, it needs to be put into action as you help yourself one careful step at a time, take the risks of the dreaded experience involved in pushing back the bars of your invisible cage so you can express yourself more fully, more authentically, in a more integrated way, and take the risks of doing that. And then when it goes well, as it usually does, take in the good, register it, learn from the fact that it went well, and restabilize now with a bigger room because you've moved the bars back. And then rinse and repeat again and again and again. So you might ask yourself in this life today, you know, what are you afraid to communicate that's true for you? What are you afraid to ask for? What are you afraid to be seen experiencing? What are you afraid to pursue that constricts you? And then ask yourself, what's the dreaded experience? And then ask yourself, okay, how could I learn to tolerate that risk so I'm not so trapped? Okay? Fundamental groundedness in insight into your own mind. That's really, really useful. And it's very helpful to pick one thing, take it out of this abstraction to one particular idea or situation where you feel kind of bound up or you're anxious with a certain person. What if you just simply said what was real for you? What are you afraid you'd experience? Now, sometimes that fear is very reasonable. That's a needful fear. You know, it's not, you fear that they would fire you or they would, you know, be violent or, you know, it would blow back against you in court in some way. Okay. Or over Thanksgiving dinner. You know, okay, you don't say that stuff. But if you really could afford to take those risks, this kind of insight can free you of a lot of anxiety over time. Okay. A related insight from psychoanalysis, psychodynamic theory, is the fundamental idea of transference. Now, that was originally in the context of a person, a client, a patient, transferring their feelings and desires, mainly for their parent, mother or father, to the psychotherapist, the psychoanalyst. But really broadly, we can now understand that the brain naturally tends to transfer into the present from our childhoods, our personal history. We generalize. So, you know, as I've said previously, I was young going through school. I felt very much like an outsider, picked last for PE teams. I was very small for my grade, and because I was a year and a half younger than most people. And, you know, that led me to having a lot of experiences of being invisible and unwanted. So then, fast forward 20 years later, here I am in some kind of, you know, professional conference. I've got a PhD. Doesn't matter. I still feel like I'm in fourth grade because it's body memory. It's emotional memory transferred into that setting where, you know, there too, even though it's actually not happening, I'm included, I'm appreciated, I'm wanted, but still I feel like somehow I have to prove myself and I'm angry at the cool kids there and I want to impress them while meanwhile feeling superior to them. Now, I'm happy to say I think pretty much about all of that in any way, but I can definitely remember that kind of transference. So here too, insight lets us know, wow, am I anxious about this as this? Or because I'm transferring meanings to it? Or I'm turbocharging or exaggerating or catastrophizing the potential impacts of this, whatever, that I'm anxious about from my childhood. Maybe I'm anxious about talking with someone who's an authority figure. Factually, let's say, probably, they're okay. You know, they might be a little grumpy or a little gruff, but they're okay. But wow, you grew up with authority figures who did not treat you well. Those fears then get transferred. So insight that can be liberating is to identify, wow, I'm bringing in all kinds of stuff that I didn't need to bring in. That's really useful. And maybe people can put examples that are real for themselves of what I'm saying as I go along. If that's helpful, that would help me and it probably would help other people too. So you might ask yourself, okay, in situations in which I feel kind of anxious, am I transferring in earlier similar experiences or beliefs, even going all the way down to very young experiences and beliefs that are distorting or amplifying or biasing or turbocharging my fearfulness, my anxiety, my uneasiness, my apprehensiveness here. I'll give another personal example. My parents were very loving and decent. They grew up in the Depression, fairly fearful. They wanted to keep their kids alive. And so they tended both to be, you know, pretty critical, including about little things, you know, or nothings, actually. So I grew up in some ways, a fault-finding home. Maybe I'm not alone in that. And so now in my work environments, in my upbringing, it was really important not to make a mistake and not to be wrong about anything, including in school, but certainly at home. And so I just noticed that I'm in environments today in which, as probably for you in many settings, the facts are in your favor. Those other people are really not out to get you. You really do have legitimacy and standing in that setting. If you make a mistake, it's not that big a deal. And yet in me, I can feel a transference even now, you know, in my advanced age, into certain settings where I really, really, really don't want to make a mistake. And it is turbocharged by my history. So what do you do, by the way, when you have this kind of insight? It starts conceptually, or there's a knowing, like you know, oh, that's true. Now, maybe that knowing starts kind of like an intuitive dim bell ringing. You know, you have an intuition. Yeah, there's something going on here under my surface that's above and beyond what the current situation really calls for. And then you deepen in that insight and gradually start making connections. Then what do you do with that? Well, very often that knowledge starts giving you some breathing room alone, and that reduces the impact of anxiety. It may still arise, but it's not so invasive and it's not so controlling and hijacking. That's really useful. Just the insight alone starts giving you that freedom. And then with that insight, you can start to sort of disentangle yourself from the reactions. More and more, it's like they're over there rather than here. You have them. You have those patterns of reaction, but it's not so much that you are them. You're increasingly disidentified from them. That starts liberating them. And then you start increasingly getting underneath them. Oh, and you know, with practice, you start sensing into what's the alternative to that way of feeling. You know, if in my case, let's say, I'm transferring in, you know, the sense of precarity, that my self-worth and my inclusion with others was always very precarious when I was young, or felt that way. Well, I might help myself by looking at my current environments, my current work settings, and realizing, hey, Rick, one, they like you, they approve you, you have a good reputation, you know, it's not so precarious. In other words, you can afford to experience, you can release the precarity, the sense of uncertainty and uneasiness, you know, always needing to prove oneself. You can release that and replace it with what's actually true. Respect, inclusion, valuing, when that's true for you. And find your own examples of this. I'm using examples that have to do with my own situation, uncommon in some ways, but you see the basic idea. Okay? In other words, I'm speaking here of my first of three types of insight, having to do with insight really from, you know, clinical psychology, particularly two big insights from psychodynamic psychology around, you know, inner conflict with material that wants to push forward for full expression, and second, insight related to transference into the present from material that, you know, is younger. Okay, so far? Somebody is making a point here about, let's see, learning to sit with anxiety and accepting anxiety. In addition to the three kinds of insight I'm describing, there are lots of other great things to do with anxiety. You know, relax the body, acceptance, letting it flow, you know, holding it in spacious awareness. There are a lot of good things to do besides, you know, insight that I'm exploring here. Okay, so let's see what else. yeah, people are giving really good examples of what I'm talking about. And I appreciate the compliments sometimes that are coming in. Thank you, by the way. Great, great, great. Okay. So yeah. So, and if you're, for example, scared to be in a small group, insight can guide you. Okay. What's the dreaded experience? So what event am I afraid of occurring? And what am I afraid I'd feel if it did? And then work backwards. How likely is the event? And how bad would I actually feel? And how could I cope with it? And then, you know, then you can move into being a friend to yourself, speaking kindly to yourself, reassuring you while you're in a small group, helping yourself take little risks, like being a little more forthright in the group or even choosing to be in a small group in the first place. I find for myself, as someone who's, you know, naturally a little shy, you know, by temperament, let alone my history, one thing I learned to do was to have my agenda be about really listening to and being interested in sincerely other people and receiving them with questions and interest, and even finding a key person in the group to just to connect with. Maybe each time the group met, a different person. You know, so I would literally sometimes work my way around the room. And then increasingly I felt at home in the group. You know, that stance of sort of receptive goodwill is really good because it lowers the pressure on yourself to perform. And it increases the odds that others will like you because, you know, we tend to like people who are, you know, relating to us with receptive goodwill. They're listening and they're interested. Okay. So I definitely want to make room for the third category of insight, the more Buddhist insight. So I'll just keep going. So a second major form of insight is real-time recognizing of the somatic markers of anxiety. Somatic markers is a term coined, I think, by Antonio Damasio, which has to do with the fact that most of our nuggets of reaction, think of them as like chunks, or Jung called them complexes because they're complex. They tend to have multiple elements. There's typically a cognitive element and an affective element, emotional element, and a desire or motivational element. Yeah, so far. And there's almost always a somatic element, both sensation and sometimes action, or preparation for action, somatic markers. And with meditation and also with practice in general, we can become much more aware of the granularity, the specificity of even fleeting somatic markers that anchor our reactions. You know, the thought is floating by, I better not say that. And associated with that thought, if you can track it, I did it right here, is a kind of clenching in my chest. I better not say that, clench. That's a somatic marker that is associated. That track, those tracks get laid down, right? If we are experiencing moment to moment to moment, the sort of cognitive track, right? The emotional track, the desire motivational track, and the somatic and enactment, action track, those are all happening at the same time. Those are getting laid down in emotional memory. And the deep root of our complexes is somatic almost always. Even if it's rooted in a certain kind of a belief, that belief typically has some pattern of sensation in the body or a tendency toward action of one kind or another, you know. I better not say that. What's that feel like in your body? You know? Okay. So when you think about anxiety, like a very subtle sense of uneasiness walking into a meeting, you can inquire with insight into your own body. Huh? What am I feeling in my belly? What's happening with my breathing? And as you bring insight into the somatic underpinnings of reaction patterns, then very often they start to soften. Because when you're aware of the tension in your diaphragm, let's say, in a particular area, for some reason, arbitrarily, the left side of your ribcage, when you're aware of it, then you can deliberately relax it and soften it. And as you soften the somatic markers and you reduce the clench or insistence of them, you're going to be reducing your anxiety as well. So that's a different kind of insight. That's a kind of felt recognition of what's true, you know, deep down inside you. So I'm going to I'll just call out certain phrases that I see in the chat so far, and I'm going to call them out and ask you just for a moment to kind of flash on, oh, what might be the embodiment, in part at least, of, you know, what the person is saying there. So I'm just going to use some phrases without naming any names here. Somebody asked me, by the way, Margot, what were the three things again, please? I don't know. You might have been referring to the meditation of, you know, peaceful, loving, and grounded. I can't think of the three things. Okay, here we go. Control. Think of the embodied sense of control. How does that land in your body? Okay. Burden. What's the sense of that in your body? Terrified. Very embodied, right? Okay. Irritation. It's embodied, isn't it? And really tuning in to the somatic track of the stream of consciousness is an incredibly useful form of insight. We might do it retrospectively, you know, after we're kind of debriefing something and trying to figure out why we got so mad or upset or just like shocked. Increasingly, you can be in real time. You're talking with someone, you know, a little bit of conflict starts to brew and you can just start to feel it in your body. You're starting to rev up or you're leaning in combatively or you're leaning back, you know, defensively. Feel it in real time in your body. I'll name a few more and then I'll keep going. So abandoned, feeling abandoned. Instant, you could feel it in your body. Guilt. Insecurity. Trapped. You can see, right? You just see the somatic sense of it. Trapped. Okay. So is that clear? I think, right? Second kind of insight, you know, observation of the somatic patterns, the sensation patterns. And sometimes it's like frozen action. A detail here that's really useful. You may know it already. I've seen some reference to trauma already. This comes from Peter Levine. Fantastic work. Basically, very often in trauma, there's a natural coping response that got thwarted, like flight or fight got thwarted. We couldn't do it. And so in the body, though, is the desire to complete the trajectory of that action that would have been so great if we could have done it when we were 4 years old, but couldn't, of course, possibly done it. So Peter talks about helping yourself find a way to complete the trajectory of the frozen action as a key element in trauma healing. Okay. Somatic experiencing, I think, is the name of his general approach. So that too is something to be aware of. What's the desire? What's the embedded desire? And then again, with insight into what it is, observation, understanding of what it is, you can play around with it. You know, you can imagine yourself punching or escaping or bringing in rescue, calling out, being heard. You know, what would be the completion of that frozen gestalt? It got stopped. But once it completes, there can be an increasing sense of freedom from that pattern of anxiety. Okay, so far? This is like a crash course in three or major aspects so far of clinical psychology. The repression, the function of repression, transference, and, you know, somaticization. Okay, now I want to move on to, gosh, Buddhist insight. And insight in a Buddhist frame, particularly early Buddhism, is highly, highly valued. There's a lot I could say about it. What are some fundamental insights that can help us with anxiety? Right. So you may know already, highly valued insights in early Buddhism are, first of all, into impermanence. Things are continually changing. And you can realize that clinging to what is changing is an immediate fast track to suffering. By definition, it's trying to hold what cannot be stopped, the endless arising of the next moment, which means we must endlessly move past the present moment. If we cling to anything categorically and we try to freeze the changingness of reality, that's immediately going to make us anxious because we can't. So one of the fundamental implications of that central insight in Buddhist practice is to release anxiety about change. Change is going to happen. Things will change. And we get anxious about not being able to stop the changes. It's going to change. Now, that's easy to say intellectually, but there can be kind of a bodily surrender when you realize, you know, you start understanding it conceptually, but then you move increasingly into realizing, wow, I just have to allow change. Another version of this is to realize, wow, I actually have very little control. And weirdly, realizing that helps you be less anxious. You might be flooded with panic for a moment. Oh no, I have little control. But then if you just realize you have very little control, then you have very little responsibility. Because responsibility has to be in proportion to power. If you don't have the power, you can't possibly have the responsibility. I think a lot of us who are achieving kind of people, probably just about everyone here in a lot of ways, it's true for me, we get really anxious about not being able to achieve, yet most of the causes of what we're trying to achieve are beyond our control, right? And what is under our control is our own efforts. And one really wonderful way to apply this insight is to relax and to admit, you know, out of my hands, you know, I can't make them like me. Make them agree with you. You can't make them do the right thing. And what you can do is take refuge in the knowing of your virtue of doing what you can. And then you're not anxious. You're less and less anxious. Because you've taken responsibility for where you do have power, your own conduct, your own inner efforts, as well as outer efforts. That's really freeing, just on this insight of impermanence. You know, there's a kind of peacefulness in accepting powerlessness when it's true. Okay. Another central insight that the Buddha recommended highly is seeing how everything's connected to everything else. Nothing arises on its own. Everything arises interdependently. As this arises, that arises. As this arises, that ceases. As this ceases, that arises. As this ceases, that ceases. You know, it's kind of central Buddha Dharma. And when we realize that everything is connected to everything else, we lighten up about our attachment to certain outcomes, because we realize, as I've said previously, that so much of what determines outcomes exists in relationship to many other things. Number one. And number two, you start to realize that you are being lived by the entire planet, you start to become a lot more willing to fall back, you know, into the arms of Gaia, you know, to just fall back and trust more. Insight is accurate that we rely on, we live dependently. And living dependently, we are lived, we are buoyed by so many things, all things broadly, energies, processes flowing through us, making us each moment. It's like, as we know, the wave is being lived in a sense by the ocean. It's being made by the ocean. There's a very deep teaching from Dogen, the great Zen master of around the, I think, late 1200s of the Common Era, roughly. Anyway, to paraphrase, this is present in his short teaching and bunch of in the context of larger teachings, the Genjo Koan. It's in this fairly short teaching that includes the well-known statement that the to study the way of awakening is to study the self. To study the self is to release the self, and to release the self is to be illuminated by, or enlightened by, or lived by, depending on the translation, all things. So it's there. The passage that I'm going to point to here, to paraphrase, is one in which he says, carrying the self out to all things, yourself out to all things, as a way of life, is foolishness. To be lived by all things, making your life as they flow through you, is wisdom. I'm paraphrasing, but it's a close paraphrase. I'll say it again. To carry yourself out to all things as a way of living is foolish. On the other hand, to allow all things to live through you as they make your life is wisdom. If we need to carry ourselves in goal-directed ways towards certain results, to push towards certain things, you know, to make them happen, we're going to be naturally anxious about the outcomes. On the other hand, and we're going to be tense and stressed and not that great to be around for other people. I'm speaking from personal experience here about myself. On the other hand, if in early, late middle age is how I locate myself in the lifespan, I'm probably, anyway, farther along. Anyway, at some point, you start to realize, wow, if I just relax, and in sports terms, let the game come to me. If I relax more and let myself be lived by and appreciatively, you know, open to influences and letting other people have their role in my life and being patient and just giving things their due, da-da. Wow, many beautiful good things are going to become manifest as they flow through me, and it's going to be a lot easier for me along the way and a lot easier on other people in my life. See the distinction? And insight into interbeing, interdependence, is the foundation of the benefits of this insight. So that's a second classic major Buddhist insight. Insight into impermanence and insight into inner being. Really good. And then a third insight really ties together everything I've talked about here. And that's insight into the second noble truth, routinely translated as craving. I think in many ways, the absolute essence, certainly of early Buddhism, is the second noble truth. And if you were to study Buddhism, it's to really, really study the second noble truth, which increasingly we can now study in a sense of liberating, you know, study with the aid of modern science. You know, and I've written a fair amount about really exploring the underlying neuropsychology, evolved neurobiology of craving. Why do we crave? And what can we do about that? So I'll just say this. very often we move into a pattern in which we're not simply being lived by our wholesome purposes or leaning into what is good for all or moving naturally toward what we like or naturally away from what we dislike. We're getting contracted about it. We're getting pressured about it. We're moving into a drive state. That's what craving is biologically. And you know what it feels like, right? Pressured, contracted, insistent, self-referential, tense, you know, tunnel vision, upset, negative affect, you know, including anxiety, right? We can have insight into the actual experience of craving in the moment. And very often that craving that arises relates to buried psychological material or disowned longings or pushed away feelings that in psychoanalytic terms are trying to move forward, right? Or we're craving as a pattern that's transferred into the present, but doesn't need us to crave with that contracted pressure drivenness to get our needs met. Maybe we did when we were young. We had to get that intense. We had to get that defended. We had to get that insistent when we were young, but we don't need to today. It's transferred in. You recall earlier I talked about transference. Transference shows up in craving, much as repression of material or trying to keep it at bay shows up in craving too. And then the somatic markers that I've talked about earlier are very present in craving too. Know what craving feels like in real time. That subtle, you know, it's kind of like there's a sequence in Buddha's chain of dependent origination. It's one of the very useful sequences. It goes from contact, a moment of a registering a stimulus, right? Sort of there's a shape, you know, and we have a dim sense, oh, okay, glazed donut. Contact. And then there's the hedonic tone, pleasant, unpleasant, neutral. Pleasant, I like donut. So far, so good. And then the Buddha taught that very often becomes a craving, which then gradually intensifies. I want the donut, my donut. I got to have the donut. And then that craving moves into clinging, insistence, demand. Tick, 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 and suffering follows. In real time, we can bring insight, we can bring awareness and observation and recognition to, oh, the trajectory of that whole dynamic, right? It starts kind of mild, gets more and more intense. Can we bring insight into it at that point to release it and then let it be okay? You know, like, hey, yeah, I'm going to let myself have that donut. And I won't tell my wife later. Or, you know, I'd like a bite or two, but I don't really want any more than that. It's okay. And you know, we're stepping on a craving. Or you look at it and you go, yeah, sweetie, to your body, I know you really want the donut. You're designed to want carbs and sweets biologically. I know. And wow, it would be such good comfort food right now, you say to yourself. But, you know, it's not good for you, not good for you. All those trans fatty acids, whatever, sugar, gluten, let's go find something that would be better or something like that. You know, I'm just making a kind of an internal trajectory here of a way of responding to craving. So I'm coming to an end. It's a quick summary. I've talked about the application of insight in three kind of three major traditions. And applying that to anxiety. And then, of course, once you have that insight, again, to emphasize this, that's just the beginning. But without insight, it's hard to have effective practice. It doesn't have traction because we don't understand what we're doing. We don't have a roadmap. We don't have conviction in why we're doing what we're doing. Like, we don't have a plan. Insight gives you that plan. And insight also gives you the recognition of what you're actually working toward. You know, insight into the ways that we're trapped and programmed and triggered implicitly contains within it some knowing of a better way, of how else we'd like to live and feel and operate with other people. So insight is just the start, but it's a very crucial start. And then after that, as I've described in some ways, we do various things that I've taught elsewhere, and you can find elsewhere too, to increasingly free ourselves from these habit patterns that are usually somatically grounded in the body that we learned, but we can become increasingly free of and replace them with other better ways of being. Remembering that anxiety may still arise while being meaningless. Anxiety may still arise out of history or trauma or just temperament, while you can recognize that it has no value for you. You don't need to believe it, and you don't need to feed it and follow it. And you don't need, because it doesn't have meaning, look for something that's threatening, because actually there's like, right now, in the present, let's say there's actually nothing that's threatening. One, it may still arise. Two, crucial point, we can deal with threats. We don't need anxiety to deal with threats. It may initially arise to kind of focus us, but after that, we can deal with threats on the basis of calm strength. Potentially fiery, if need be, but we're strong. We don't have to be anxious to deal with threats. Last, I don't know about you. I remember back in America during, I think, the early 2000s with George Bush, the son of George Bush. Anyway, war on terror, as if you could have a war on terror. But in any case, threat level orange. And I remember walking through airports and, you know, any kind of wannabe authoritarian regime throughout history uses fear-mongering. And bullies of various kinds use fear-mongering. And I'm saying this as a general statement. So, you know, threat level orange. There'd be big signs. I'd get on it, you know, in an airport. And I knew that the actual odds of a bad event on my plane that day were nearly zero, were vanishingly small. Driving to the airport was riskier for me than some kind of terrorist hijack of, you know, my flight to San Diego. And I just refused to be triggered and intimidated by these flashing lights and warnings every minute. Threat level orange, threat level orange. You know, there's something inside that I think is really important to stand up against bullying, stand up against fear-mongering, stand up against old habits of fear that got laid down in you by people who wanted you to be scared, and yet they're dead or long gone or you've moved away. You know, there's a place here that just says, dang, no, I want to deal with life with my head up. I want to be clear-eyed. I want to see real threats. I don't want to be distracted from real threats by internal preoccupations with anxiety. And fundamentally, I don't want to be some kind of puppet pulled by other people's, you know, fear-mongering threads. To me, that's a place that has a place in all this too. You know, you could just make a commitment to say to yourself, you know, I'm going to study anxiety. I've done that, actually. Then I later on, I studied anger, and, you know, then I worked on remorse, and I don't know what's next, but it'll be something, I'm sure. And you could just say to yourself, you know, I'm not going to feel any more scared than I need to feel, than is useful. Just decide and say, I'm going to increasingly release unnecessary anxiety. And it's an incredible practice. It really is.